Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and the topic of our presentation is progressivism and how progressivism affected the Constitution. My gosh, you could have a whole course on this. So I'm going to try to do it in about 30 minutes and hit some of the highlights and some of the important issues that are going to happen during this particular period of time. And of course, this progressive idea is going to filter into the New Deal and some of the other things we're going to talk about in a little bit in the course and even into the modern era. In fact, you could reasonably argue that the progressive era began, say, in the late 19th century, in particular with foreign policy, and we're still living in it. Progressivism has drastically changed the nature of the United States, the nature of the Constitution, the way we think about government. It's one of the most destructive things that the United States has ever gone through. Some people would say that progressivism actually would stretch back to the founding period, and I tend to disagree. The founders were more of conservatives in the way that they looked at government. I mean, they were reaching back to the Greeks and the Romans for models. They weren't trying to create something entirely new. And I think when you look at the progressives, particularly when you start looking at the middle of the 19th century with reformers, you're starting to look at utopian idealism as a major component of that. And that idealism is destructive. It's dangerous because the America in which these people live is an America that never existed. It's an America that only exists within the confines of their mind. And so what they're going to try to do is use legislation to affect that idea and to make change, which is a popular term, happen. I mean, so when Obama gets up there and in 2008 talks about hope and change, he was exposing himself as an ardent progressive. And he said so many stupid things over his time as president, even more recently, when I understand in his acceptance speech this time around, he said we were one colony that essentially broke away from the British Empire for democracy, right? And so this is the distortion of history, and this is what the progressives do. When he was inaugurated the first time in 2009, he said that we're going to continue recreating America. Well, my gosh, that's what we've been doing now for 150 years. And he meant it. I mean, the idea of the progressives to have an idea, the charge of progressives is to have an idea and then act on that idea and make that idea happen. And so, you know, if government isn't broke, fix it until it is. And that's pragmatism. This is the general basis behind progressivism. It's scary. And I wish that more people would see that. I think that progressivism has gotten more of its due in the last, say, 4 years as people have rediscovered some of this stuff. It's unfortunate that it's taken that long for people to start figuring this out, but the progressives are the most destructive force in human history. So let's look and see how they affected the Constitution and the nature of the government, because I'm going to talk about some of their legislation and how it fits in with progressivism, and then, of course, look at how they altered the Constitution ultimately. So first and foremost, Frankenstein. I call it Frankenstein for a reason. Let's talk about this progressive ethos. The general progressive ethos was that every day man is getting better in every way. And when you looked around in the 19th century and early 20th century, you saw that, my gosh, I mean, we've got all these wonderful things. We now have advancements in transportation. We have advancements in, comforts of life. You know, we have electricity, for example, and all these new toys that come with electricity. We have people that are advancing philosophically, and of course you have Charles Darwin and others saying that humans evolve. Forget about this idea of creationism and man is kind of the static being. That's what the Greeks had said. You know, history is cyclical, and so man is static. The one constant is always man and human nature. Forget about that whole thing. Man is evolving. Everything evolves. It's now survival of the fittest. You have, you know, Herbert Spencer in saying that. And to be honest with you, this was something that was affecting the entire political spectrum. I mean, but you did have some people that, for example, were called progressives and these, Darwinists, people like William Graham Sumner, who I think that's a little bit of a reach because they didn't necessarily believe in that idealistic perfectibility of man. I think that they thought that there was a general order to man, but they didn't take it as far as, say, the reformed Darwinists took it. And said, okay, now that we know what human nature is, and of course what evolution is, now we know the evils of evolution, we can correct that. We can level society. And how are we going to do that? We're going to use legislation to do it. We're going to make sure that we level society both economically and morally and socially through legislation. So give us the hammer of the government, and that hammer will now go out there and affect everything in society. That's basically what the progressives are doing this entire time. Now, I put up here Herbert Croly. and the creation of modern liberalism. Herbert Croly is one of these forgotten figures in American history. He's a disaster, and he's a model of the intelligentsia. I talked about Herbert Croly in my politically incorrect guide to real American heroes. He's one of the frauds. He's one of the democratic frauds that I talk about in there. But anyways, Croly wrote a interesting book entitled The Promise of American Life. And essentially, if you want to call Croly anything, I say the creation of modern liberalism. He's the creation of modern guns and butter. Because what Croly thought was that we needed to have a very aggressive national government, so centralization, that would have an aggressive domestic and foreign policy agenda, meaning that we should go out there and create an empire. He thought that was a good idea, all in the name of liberty and democracy. He thought it was a good idea to centralize control, to actually give up your liberty to the central authority in the name of the collective good. So in some ways, you know, he's kind of this reformed Marxist. I mean, he doesn't really call himself a socialist, but, you know, this is national socialism, essentially what he's talking about. I mean, you know, having the government involved in corporations. He's talking about fascism. And that's what Croly is. And of course, Croly would be widely read and by a lot of progressives, namely Teddy Roosevelt. And he's the precursor of, you know, Woodrow Wilson's Making the World Safer Democracy. Everyone was reading Croly. And Croly even thought by the end of his life that this stuff had gone too far, and he actually was working on a book denouncing all of this stuff that came out of his first book, saying, no, I didn't mean this, I didn't mean that. But of course, the Pandora's box was already open, the genie was already out of the bottle, and so people were running with this stuff. And of course, that's where we are today. You know, progressives disregarded the Constitution. Croly did. He thought, he knew all this stuff that he was talking about was unconstitutional. So forget it. Basically, he said, put the Constitution in a shredding machine. Who cares about it? We have a loose construction. As long as you can find some type of justification in the Constitution, as long as it's within the letter and spirit of the law. Now, remember back into the 19th century, people like John Marshall said this. Alexander Hamilton essentially said this. And he dusted off Hamilton. That Frankenstein for Croly was a combination of Hamilton and Jefferson, which gives us modern liberalism. You got Hamilton with the act of central authority. You got Jefferson with the democratic ideal, which Jefferson wasn't necessarily a Democrat like we think of. He didn't believe in universal equality and or universal suffrage. And then you have this monster that we have today that forces people on the who are, you know, paleoconservatives or libertarians into a box, because we can't break that power of that central authority. It's very, very difficult. Croly knew it. Once you start talking about nationalism, and nationalism becomes democracy, and democracy becomes reform, these are very powerful slogans that people buy into. Well, I don't want to be called anti-democratic. Well, I don't want to be, I don't want to be seen as a guy who's backwards and not for reform. I don't want to be seen as, you know, someone who's not for progress. I like progress. Progress is good. So yeah, I'm a progressive. He actually wrote in his book that we shouldn't look back to examples, for examples, on what we should do. We should only think about our ideas and our mind and what we should do. I mean, this is crazy. That just ignores what Patrick Henry had said in 1775. You know, the lamp of experience is which I'm guided. And they talked about the Greeks and the Romans and Cicero and all these great individuals. They read the Greek historians and the Roman historians, and they saw in these different books what to do and what not to do. Crowley's saying, forget all that stuff. He would go back to the founding period for perhaps a way to work around history rather than rely on it for examples. And again, you're going to get centralization of power. That's one of the key components of progressivism, centralized power. And what did that come down to? Of course, the executive branch. So executive usurpation and the prime minister president. And I'll get into that in a later slide in this presentation. But you have to have a strong executive. If you don't have a strong executive, then progressivism is not going to work. So this is why when you look at the modern American government, you have Barack Obama and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton and, you know, George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, you know, Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon. I mean, take your pick, Lyndon Johnson, FDR, you know, take your pick of these individuals. They all believed in that centralization of power in one way or another. I can't think of anyone, even Reagan. You know, Reagan often gets a free pass, and I'm not anti-Reagan in that. I think Reagan was the best of the bunch in the last, my gosh, almost 100 years. But even Reagan had his faults, and of course it's because of Ronald Reagan that we have the rise of neoconservatism, which is just the most destructive force, because essentially neoconservatism is kind of like this Herbert Crowley stuff. I mean, it's old TR Republicanism, and I think that's the real problem with it, and why nobody can get behind it. Sure, they talk a good game, and they'll say, we need to cut government, but they don't really mean that, because, of course, they want a larger defense, which means offense expenditures, and they want more government control of the economy and society, just in different ways, as the progressives are going to be doing in this time. So there isn't really a good anti-centralization party out there anymore. It just doesn't exist. We haven't really had it since you had the classical liberals going after the government in the late 19th century. People like Grover Cleveland, again, William Graham Sumner, and some individuals like that, and E.L. Godkin, and you just don't have it anymore. All right, empire. This is a major component of progressivism, and what you're looking at here is the abuse of the war power. So I put it into a constitutional history, just generally some of the things that are going on. There's wonderful books out there about this, and this is also part of the Reconstruction period, because you know, once the North is done beating up on the South in the name of liberty and democracy, and that's essentially how it was used, then they go out west and they beat up on the Indians in the name of liberty and democracy, and then when they can't beat up on the Indians anymore, then they start beating up on other countries in the name of liberty and democracy, or to follow the dollar. So for this economic power. So here we have some of the ideas going around here. Hawaii. Actually, it'll be an American-led overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy in 1893, up into 1896. It's going to cause the United States to eventually annex Hawaii. Now, of course, in 1893, when this all begins, Grover Cleveland, who was president, wasn't for it, wouldn't annex Hawaii. He didn't really support the overthrow, but it did have the support of the American military there, because the American military was used as a coercive force not to fire any shots, but to ensure that the Hawaiians themselves didn't go and take out this coup that was taking place. So you have the backing of the military. Again, this is abuse of war powers. What is the American military doing in another country supporting the overthrow of a government, even though these are Americans who are staging the overthrow? They shouldn't be doing this in the first place. But the Navy's there, so they use it. The Spanish-American War in Cuba. The Spanish-American War began because supposedly we wanted to secure the independence of the Cubans and the Filipino people for humanity's sake. And this is the guns and butter idea. Here we have guns, you know. So we're going to go out there and we're going to make sure that the Spanish are put in line. Of course, they had concentration camps in Cuba. We told them to clean that stuff up. They did. And then the Maine blows up. The USS Maine blows up in Havana Harbor. And of course, then essentially the Americans call for the invasion of Spanish territory. This is why William Graham Sumner, in a very famous essay, mourned this particular war, because he said it was the conquest of the United States by Spain. Essentially, the United States had dropped its reliance on the founding tradition, which was non-interference, which was a non-imperialistic foreign policy with an imperialistic foreign policy that the Spanish have been using since the 1500s. So here we are now becoming Spain. And when we give Cuba back to the Cubans, I mean, because we're such nice people, we attach the Platt Amendment to it, which said the United States could get involved in Cuban affairs anytime we wanted. And we do. Several times. I mean, Cuba basically becomes a protectorate of the United States up until the 1930s. And when we release them from that protectorate status, we still have a puppet government there, essentially, that's behind us. And that's what will happen with Castro. I mean, he'll come to power because the United States is obnoxious. There's a lot of anti-American sentiment in Cuba because of it. This is this aggressive, in so many ways, unconstitutional action by the United States in our foreign policy. That's going to cause all kinds of problems here. Now, of course, we did actually have a declaration of war against Spain. That's one positive about this. I mean, you can say we did follow the Constitution in that way. But acquiring territory and then using military occupation of that territory and foreign peoples, I mean, this is something that, you know, it's just really never been done before, not least overseas. The Filipino insurrection, I put that on here because, you know, the Filipino people think that the United States are the liberators. And then, of course, we go back on that and occupy the Philippines. And it takes 70,000 troops to put down this insurrection in the early 20th century. And some of the central figures in this particular war and then the later occupation are some of the same Union guys, the Northerners, that had been subduing the South during Reconstruction. It's the same thing. In fact, William Howard Taft, a great progressive in his own right, called the Filipino people his little brown brothers. So you had this kind of racial dynamic to to empire at this time. And then, of course, we have state-led intervention. When I say state-led, I'm talking about the United States, led intervention in Nicaragua and Panama in the early progressive era. We have the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. In fact, in Nicaragua and Panama were actually, you know, Panama were helping create the country of Panama by destabilizing Colombia. And then in Nicaragua, we're actually leading to the overthrow of the leader of the governor of Nicaragua and to put in our own puppet government there. Well, this is horrible stuff, and it just continues to do this in Honduras and then on down the line up until the, you know, the 19 good neighbor policy supposedly during Franklin Roosevelt. But you know, this is all an abuse of war powers. The Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. We're going to become the policemen of the West. I mean, this is just preposterous of the Western Hemisphere. It's just preposterous to think about this and think that this is even it should be even remotely a part of American foreign policy and isn't even in any way constitutional, because we start engaging these countries militarily at times without a declaration of war. So now the idea of an aggressive executive being able to force his will, what Roosevelt called his big stick diplomacy, anywhere that he wants to at any time, is blatantly an abuse of executive powers. Taxes. So I mentioned this in the last presentation. We're going to get our first income tax, of course, during the War Between the States in 1861. That particular tax would actually expire in 1872. Then the tax would be reestablished in 1894 through something called the Wilson-Gorman Act. And, of course, that was part of a tariff reduction plan. But the Supreme Court the next year said that that particular tax was unconstitutional in the case of Pollock v. Farmers Loan and Trust Company. They said that this was a direct tax, an income tax. And according to the Constitution, direct taxes had to be apportioned by population, essentially. So you couldn't have a direct tax in this way. So this is completely unconstitutional to have an income tax. So here the Republicans try it. That tax expires. Now, the Wilson-Gorman Act, of course, was passed during the Cleveland administration. And, you know, it was a Democratic-led measure because we were reducing the tariff. And so they thought they had to compensate for that with perhaps an income tax. And again, declared unconstitutional the very next year. In fact, it was during the Cleveland administration, we're going to get our, you know, in that time period, the late 19th century, we get our billion-dollar government. I mean, people were starting to talk about this. My gosh, we're spending $1 billion. This is ridiculous. A $1 billion, government. It was just unheard of. And of course, now it's the $1 trillion government. So, in 1913, there was enough clamoring for an income tax. In 1913, we're going to get the passage of the 16th Amendment, which allowed for an income tax. Now, it didn't, if you look at the 16th Amendment, it doesn't say what kind of income tax. It just says you can do it. Of course, there's this theory going around this thing's unconstitutional. Well, once you add an amendment to the Constitution, it becomes constitutional. You can't say the income tax is unconstitutional when you have an amendment to the Constitution saying you can do it. So it's not unconstitutional. But the thing about the income tax, it doesn't say what kind of income tax you have to have. And it's, of course, progressivism, which is, this part of it is founded off of Marxism that says you have to have a graduated income tax. It's what Karl Marx called for in the Communist Manifesto and Frederick Engels. We have to have a graduated income tax. But it also must be noted that the tax was actually not compulsory until after World War II. There's these great cartoons out there on YouTube, you can go find them, of Donald Duck urging people to pay their income taxes during World War II because they need it for the war effort. Now, my gosh, wouldn't that be wonderful if it was just voluntary? Oh, well, I feel like sending some money to the government, or I don't. But the government figured out pretty quickly, if you make an income tax voluntary, nobody's going to pay it. So they had to try to persuade people to do it. And then, of course, you have in the 1954, I think it is, you get the compulsory income tax. Well, they start making it the law that you have to pay. Still, there's the argument that you don't have to. And, of course, Peter Schiff's father's rotting in jail because of this. He didn't pay his taxes. we have the withdrawal tactic put into place by Milton Friedman just to say, all right, we'll just pull it out of their paycheck. They'll never even know it's gone. That's essentially withholding. That's essentially what we get now. So if that wasn't the case, and Friedman knew this, if you just had people, at the end of the year get a tax bill, you'd have a tax revolt. I mean, imagine now if at the end of the year the government just says, okay, file your taxes, and that's how much you owe. You would have a tax revolt because people couldn't do it. So you have to, give it, take it little bit by little bit, and then they're happy because they don't really see the money. But basically, this is income redistribution. And the first income tax was a very low amount. Wilson started making it popular to just tax the tar out of the top group, you know, maybe up to 75%. So we had tax rates even, you know, higher than that at some point, you know, up to 90% on very high level incomes. And this is crazy. But that's what we had. So it was just, it was dramatic income redistribution through the income tax. And then, of course, there's this idea of democracy. Do we have a federal or a national government? Of course, in the progressive era, we're going to get a national government. And so we start trying to minimize the power of the states through various tactics, and we're going to enlarge the voting population. Of course, under the 15th Amendment, we get the ability for anyone to vote regardless of race. And then, of course, in the 19th Amendment, we get women having the ability to vote, and that's going to double the voting electorate. And, of course, this does change the way people have to campaign and the issues that are going to become important. So you're now adding a tremendous number of people to the rolls, and that does affect politics. I mean, we can see that nowadays. You have a gender gap. You have a race gap. I mean, this does affect how elections are won or lost, the issues that are important, the things that people talk about. It matters, in all these things. Now perhaps an issue like, monetary policy, may take, third or fourth place, or maybe even last place behind other issues that people think are more important. And that's the travesty of all of this. And of course, the founding generation was very suspicious of direct democracy and universal suffrage. And we're going to get direct democracy out of this too. You know, some of the tactics that are used now on the state and local level, because they thought that this could be disastrous for the country, disastrous for the states, disastrous for the people as a whole, because you now have to demagogue to get people to vote for you. And you have to talk about things that may not even be not frivolous things, may not even be very important to in the long run, you know, major issues. So, the 19th Amendment is going to drastically alter the electorate, and of course, now you have to appeal to a whole new group of people. And then, of course, you have the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment fundamentally altered the nature of the central government, because the 17th Amendment gave us the direct election of senators. Now, it was thought that in the progressive era that the Senate was controlled by the political parties. It was, you know, senators were made in backroom, you know, smoke-filled room deals on the party bosses, and so the people got screwed in this entire process. But that's not entirely true. In fact, what would start happening even before the progressive era, you would have something called canvassing. The legislatures would actually go out, and they would try to determine who the people would support for a senator. Now, if you look at, you know, the states today, some of the states, of course, may be dominated by the Democratic Party, but they've got Republican senators, or vice versa. And so you might see a situation where the whole composition of the Senate would change. And it's really interesting, in the founding period, there was actually discussion about having senators being able to be recalled by the states. And some states, you know, had this idea floating around out there that if a senator's not voting in a particular way they want them, they'll just call them home. They'll reprimand them. That reprimanding did happen quite a bit when senators got out of line and didn't do what the state told them to do. And so they had to wait for instructions from their state. So in so many ways, the Senate, at least theoretically, was supposed to be the ambassadors from the states. And the Senate had, of course, control over the executive branch, because they are the ones that approve presidential nominations. They have some input in foreign policy. They're that check on the House of Representatives in terms of spending and taxing policy. They can make, you know, alterations to spending bills and tax bills. And this was brought up. We have this kind of aristocratic part of the Congress that's the brake on everything. It was the state check on the entire system. Well, now that you make it directly, these people directly elected, it's just another office. And so now they have to campaign just like anyone else. They got to raise all the money. It becomes a popularity contest. It doesn't really matter anymore. Senators are so aloof and detached from the population, they don't really care what you say. At least when they were elected by the state legislatures had some control over them. And of course, you have more control over your state legislature than you do over your senator. So this has drastically altered the system and made it a more national government. If there's any amendments we could repeal, I think the 17th should be on the top of the list, because this destroyed the original founding, the founding document of the Constitution. It destroyed the Union of the Founders more than anything else. You can look at Lincoln and all the things happened there. Yeah, that was part of it. But by the time we get the 17th Amendment, that's disastrous. And of course, you got the Fed, America's central banking institution today. And, you know, kind of a review of what's happened here. A central bank was rejected at the Philadelphia Convention. The Pennsylvania delegation wanted one, as I talked about early on. They didn't get it, so just go to Philadelphia and get it there. Well, they couldn't get it there, so they get Hamilton to do it. And of course, Hamilton was the puppet of Robert Morris in terms of financial policy in so many ways. So now we get Hamilton proposing a Bank of the United States in 1791. We get that, and of course, the Jefferson-Hamilton feud there. But it expires in 1811, so then we get the second Bank of the United States in 1816. Madison essentially signs it into law, not really saying that it's constitutional, but because it's precedent that he has to do so. I mean, what's changed? Because Madison was one of the leading opponents of it in 1791. That expires in 1836. And there was a question of constitutionality of both. Jackson actually vetoed the second Bank of the United States, a recharter of the second Bank of the United States, called it unconstitutional. And then, of course, he did the disastrous Pet Banks plan. But regardless, I think that was one of the few things Jackson was right about in his entire administrations in vetoing that second bank. What he did after that was wrong, but at least vetoing it was good policy. But he didn't have anything to replace it with, so you have some financial turmoil. And then, of course, we get the Supreme Court in 1819, through McCulloch v. Maryland, saying it is constitutional because he's just dusting off Alexander Hamilton here. John Marshall is, if the ends justify the means, we can have the bank. It's necessary and proper. We got to do it. Then, of course, you have the National Banking Act, the National Bank Acts, 1863 and 1864, which established another central banking system. And that was thought we needed some reform with that. So in 1913, you get the Owen-Glass Act, which established the Federal Reserve System. From the beginning, central banking had been dubious and unconstitutional, regardless of what Marshall said. The idea of a central bank, of course, the Bank of England had one, and central banking always allows the government to spend more money than it has, to engage in disastrous wars or expensive wars, to do things it just shouldn't be able to do in its monetary policy. And so that's what the Fed has done. It's no different. In fact, I'm sure you all heard the term for the Fed. It's the creature from Jekyll Island. This is a monstrous problem in American history. And it's one of those things that should be corrected. Could you get a repeal of the Federal Reserve System? Perhaps you'd have to have something else to place it with. I mean, the independent treasury worked fine for a long period of time in American history, and perhaps that's something we should go back to, maybe a modified form, but something like that. But you have to get people talking about these issues. And one of the great things that Ron Paul has done, if you just want to bring that into it, modern politics, he's actually made these issues front and center in a lot of ways and getting young people to think about monetary policy. So instead of talking about stupid nonsense on the campaign trail, I mean, that's the great thing about liberty people and, Mises subscribers and paleo conservatives and people like that. They actually talk about real issues. And perhaps, this is going to be a long war. It took the progressives 100 years to get to where we are today. It could take us 100 years to get it back. But as long as these issues are addressed now, we can start talking about these things, and maybe they could come to fruition. And then, of course, there's executive usurpation, the executive legislative agenda. Of course, we get Teddy Roosevelt with the Square Deal, Woodrow Wilson with the New Freedom. The president became the political leader of the nation. So you have not just the president as an executive, the president executing the laws and dealing with head of state issues, foreign policy, which is his primary goal and primary job as per the Constitution, Article 2. Now the president becomes the prime minister. He has to have a legislative agenda, and he has to go out there. And I mean, this campaign was so stupid in one way. When Mitt Romney in 2012 was telling Barack Obama, "Well, you don't have a plan." Well, my gosh, the Congress is the one that's supposed to have a plan, not the president. The president shouldn't have a legislative agenda. That's what Congress has. And then the president, of course, should only veto legislation if it's unconstitutional. That's the way the founders looked at it, generally. And that's the way Grover Cleveland did it. I mean, he used the veto as a wrecking ball to go after unconstitutional legislation that kept crossing his desk. He said, "Look, it's unconstitutional. You can't do this." So that's the way the veto was supposed to be used. But now he has a political agenda, a legislative agenda. If you don't follow his political or legislative agenda, he's going to veto legislation. Burton Folsom had a great deal, New Deal or Raw Deal, and I think that's what we have to start calling all these agendas. They're all raw deals. I mean, every time the president comes up with a legislative agenda, the real people getting screwed are the American people, because it's always a raw deal. And so, abuse of government powers during World War I, the emergency, these were emergency powers supposedly, but you're going to get the centralization of the economy. Woodrow Wilson out there nationalizing the railroads, for example, and directing production, directing prices, directing consumption. All the stuff that was famous during World War II, well, it was all piloted during World War I. We had a fascist economy during World War I. We have a fascist economy during the New Deal in World War II. That's what we have. Woodrow Wilson is the pioneer of all this stuff. We get sedition laws. So sedition law in 1798 is not enough. Now we get one during World War I, which results in even more people getting taken, hauled off to prisons and deported and everything else simply because they opposed the war. I mean, you can argue that a lot of these socialists and Marxists were not good people, but they should have the right to say what they want to say. You can say they're wrong, but they shouldn't be put in prison for it. That's what they would do, right? So, I mean, we don't need to be like them. The model for FDR during World War II, as I just mentioned, I mean, FDR didn't have to go very far back in time to find out, okay, well, we did this during World War I, the American people accepted it, we should do it during World War II. Sounds good, right? I mean, it gives us our fascist government, which is what we always wanted. And, of course, then you have Prohibition, I put this quote up there. There's this little video out there, it has these old ladies standing there during Prohibition, and I don't drink, and therefore you shouldn't drink either, right? So, I mean, it's because they don't drink, nobody else should drink. Because they don't do immoral things, nobody else should. We need government to make sure people don't. I mean, yeah, we can all think that, being a drunkard's not a good thing. Perhaps being a drug addict's not a good thing. Sleeping with prostitutes and, doing immoral things is not really good for you. It's not good for society to have this. But at the same time, should the government be involved at the federal level in any ways, saying you can't have these things? I mean, I think there's an argument, if a community, a city, or a county wants to have a dry county or, have laws against prostitution and, drugs or things like that. Well, I mean, that's the will of the people in that small area. Perhaps that would be more effective than just saying a blanket statement across the board, all this stuff is illegal. Now, Prohibition, of course, started in 1914 with the Harrison Act, which went after narcotics. So now you can't get narcotics without a prescription. And essentially what they were doing is basically saying you can't get narcotics. Because at this point, you could go out and you could get, for example, opium over the counter. It was laudanum. You could take it for headaches. And, of course, people became opium addicts out of it. But there were opium tents and opium dens and all kinds of stuff. You could just go get opium anytime you wanted. It was over the counter. That was seen as negative, a bad thing for society. So now we're going to make it illegal. Then, of course, the Marijuana Tax Act of 1931, Harry Anslinger and the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. I mean, this is a way for the government to get involved in this and say all these drugs that they don't think people should be doing are illegal. And there's a tremendous amount of racism involved here. Anslinger thought that, only Mexicans and black jazz musicians were out there smoking marijuana. So we need to make sure that people don't do this stuff, because it's, all these bad people. And take it away from society, and we get the federal campaign against these things. And it'll be interesting to see what happens now with Colorado and Washington legalizing recreational use for marijuana, because to see what the federal government does, whether they're going to crack down on that. The question, of course, and the way they've always gotten around this is that you can't traffic these drugs. But as we know, that's only interstate commerce. What happens intrastate? If you grow marijuana in the state of Colorado and then sell it in the state of Colorado and nowhere else, then how can the federal government even regulate that? So, I mean, that's the real question. And again, this is state versus federal power. And, of course, we get the 18th Amendment of the Constitution, which prohibits the sale, consumption, and distribution of alcohol, later repealed in 1932 through an amendment to the Constitution. So, it's remarkable that this particular issue has hung around as long as it has, and people tend to think this is a conservative position. No, these were the reformers. These were the progressives out there trying to push this stuff. Okay, so summary. You get a fundamental shift in federal versus state power in the early 20th century. I didn't really get into, executive powers, but one component of that, is that general fascist ideology, kind of the dictator, the central dictator of America. Franklin Roosevelt was having what he called dictators. It's one thing I forgot to mention. He had dictators, which became our czars. So you just circumvent the legislative process entirely and have these dictators. But Crowley's model of an active democratic national government became the basis of the modern assault on true federalism and the shredding of the Constitution. I mean, this is what you're getting in the progressive era, quick and dirty analysis of it. If you want more of this, of course, you can look at our general U.S. history course. We get into detail on some of these other things. But the Constitution is being completely changed, altered, in so many ways during this period that it becomes unrecognizable. The Union of the Founders is gone, particularly by the time you get to World War II and the New Deal and all the things that go on there. So, I hope you enjoyed this presentation, and I'll see you next time.